Hello, it's Lena Dunham. I host a podcast called The C Word with my dearest friend and historian of bad behavior, Alyssa Bennett.
What is up?
It's a chat show about women whose society is called crazy.
We're going to be rediscovering the stories of women society dismissed by calling them mad, sad, or just plain bad.
Listen to and follow The C Word with Lena Dunham and Alyssa Bennett, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Rico Bronya's presented by FanDuel Sportsbook. Make every moment more.
Tito's Handmade Vodka is America's favorite vodka for a reason. From the first legal distillery in Texas, Tito's is six times distilled till it's just right. And naturally gluten-free, making it a high-quality spirit that mixes with just about anything. From the smoothest martinis to the best Bloody Marys, Tito's is known for giving back, teaming up with nonprofits to serve its communities and do good for dogs. Make your next cocktail with Tito's. Distilled and bottled by Fifth Generation Inc., Austin, Texas. 40% alcohol by volume. Savor responsibly.
What's up, guys? I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. We're heading towards the home stretch of the WNBA season, and there is so much to get into every episode. Twice a week, I'm joined by one of my amazing co-hosts as we dissect the biggest games, performances, and even some off-court drama. The playoffs are quickly approaching, and now is the best time to tune in. Who will come away as this year's champion? The competition is heating up, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the amazing Rico Bronya podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is a brand spanking new edition of Rico Bronya. I'll tell you why it's a very special edition. Is it special because Ryan Helsley sucks and we're going to rip him for a little bit of time? Not really. Is it special because Nolan McLean continues to be the truth? Maybe a little bit. Is it special because the Mets won two out of three against a quality opponent in the Detroit Tigers? Partially. But it is special because of the number episode we're about to partake in. Episode 541. Hopefully, the amount of career home runs that Pete Alonso ends up with. But no, that's not the reason it's special. This is a geeky Mets podcast. 5, David Wright. 41, the greatest of them all, George Thomas Seaver. So episode 541 represents two of the greatest New York Mets of all time. With that said, we got a lot to discuss on this, Rico, good and bad. Get you set for the Cincinnati series. Talk about the handling of Kodai Senga, Francisco Alvarez. There's a million things to get to, so let's get comfortable. I do want to start with a positive. The Mets lost on Wednesday afternoon to the Detroit Tigers, and I think sometimes when you lose the last game of a series, it takes away from the accomplishment of a series. The Mets went to Detroit against a team with one of the best records in the American League, and they won 2 out of 3. And that, to me, is the headline. The Mets went to Detroit, and they won 2 out of 3 against a damn good baseball team. So I think we should be happy. I don't think that despite the way they lost on Wednesday, and we will get into it, despite some of the concerns that come out of Wednesday, we will get into it. I don't think that this, Rico, should be reeking of negativity, because ultimately the Mets had a good week. They won 2 out of 3 against the Tigers. Now, before we get into each individual game, I think when you look at this series, you can see the good and the bad that may eventually hit us in the 2025 New York Mets. What do I mean by that? Well, here's the good. Let's get the good right in there. This offense in the first two games of the series showed us what they can be. The offense that I dreamt of, the offense I projected back in March when we were doing spring training, Ricos, you saw an offense not only score a bunch of runs in game one, win a game 10-8, and then scored 12 runs in game two. So, yes, my math tells me they scored 22 runs in the first two games. But you saw something that the Mets haven't had a lot of this year, and that's not the glass jaw, but the iron jaw. We saw the Mets respond. You go back to game one, they're down 1-0 before you can blink. Remember when Sean Manaea threw the first pitch hanger to Jamai Jones and he plucked it out of the ballpark? And then they took a lead, and then they were trailing again. Then they took a lead, and they blew the lead. Like, the Mets showed a lot of fight in game one of this series, and they scored a lot of runs. The Mets also played really good defense at times throughout this series. We even saw Cedric Mullins make a great diving play in center. We saw Pete Alonso make some really good plays around first. That's a part of the good. The other good we saw, and this is a major weapon that the New York Mets have, Edwin freaking Diaz. How many teams have the ability in the eighth inning to say, we're going to go to our lockdown closer, and we have the utmost confidence that guy's going to get the job done? We saw that in this series. Now, the positive, in the first two games, that is, we saw clutch inning. We saw the Mets continue to kind of even out their awful start with runners in scoring position by hitting a crap ton with guys on base. And the other thing we saw, and maybe this is the thing that excites all of us the most, and that is the man who towed the rubber in game two of this three-game series, Nolan McClain. More on him later. So we saw the offense. We saw clutch hitting. We saw not the glass jaw, but the iron jaw. And we saw the ace. And I think as we embark through September and hopefully October, those things I described, offense, clutch hitting, Edwin Diaz, Nolan McClain, that's why we have hope. That's why we have belief. Now let's get to the negative. The negative is when Nolan McClain doesn't pitch, like we saw in game one with Sean Manaea, and we saw in game three from Clay Holmes, are you getting five innings from your starter? Like, think about this difference between Clay Holmes and Nolan McClain. Clay Holmes, after his game on Wednesday, was asked a lot about, boy, that's the best changeup you had all year. Boy, your stuff was electric. Not denying any of that's true. He went 4 2/3 innings. So on a day in which Clay Holmes had his best stuff and great changeup command, and it was clicking out of his hand, he went 4 2/3 innings. On the opposite note, Nolan McClain didn't have his best stuff in game two. He could not throw his sweeper for a strike. And we saw that when he walked back-to-back guys in the first inning. We saw that when he walked the leadoff hitter in the second inning. Nolan McClain was off. What did Nolan McClain do again? Oh, that's right. He finished six innings and allowed two runs in his fourth major league start. So in one breath, Clay's got great stuff. Oh, let's go nuts. He couldn't finish the fifth inning. A lot of that's on Mendy. I'll get to that later. Nolan McClain doesn't have his best stuff, is kind of shaky, and he goes six innings, two runs. If Clay Holmes goes six innings, two runs, we're having a party. So the negative is we saw the bugaboo. The starters don't go deep into games. We saw it in game one with Sean Manaea. We saw it in game three with Clay Holmes. What's the other bugaboo? Outside of Diaz and Brooks Raley, their bullpen is not good. Gregory Soto had a rough few days. And it doesn't help that you got to go to your bullpen in the fifth inning, obviously. But it is not a great bullpen. Ryan Helsley is a disaster. Tyler Rogers has been shaky. Gregory Soto has certainly been shaky. So this is not like a positive. We thought it would be a positive. We thought after the trade deadline, the bullpen would be loaded. It's not. And then the other negative that we saw specifically in game three is sometimes the offense just disappears. And in game three of this series, it did. They had a few big opportunities. They came up small. So I think in a lot of ways, these three games in which the Mets overall had success because they won two out of three showed us all the different things about this team. The positives, like I laid out, and the negatives. And that's why I think you go into this off day and you go into the Cincinnati series probably with a lot of mixed feelings about this team. Some belief, some hope, and some concerns. Let's get to game one. The concern you have coming out of game one, I think, is twofold. I think number one, it's Sean Manaea. I am waiting. You are waiting. We're all waiting for Sean Manaea to finally click it in. And I think there's a few things that could be going on with his struggles. Number one, he may not be healthy. You know, we all recall that he had the loose bodies in his elbow and he was going to pitch through it. And I think what you're seeing from us, especially anyone who wants to rip Sean Manaea, which I will. He wasn't effective. He gave up multiple home runs, including the leadoff hitter Jamai Jones and then the Winseal Perez two-run bomb in the third inning. He wasn't good, and he couldn't get through the fourth inning. So obviously Manaea was not good. He deserves criticism for his performance. But Manaea may be pitching hurt. That's on the table. And it is certainly fair to say, well, you're pitching. So I don't care if you're hurt. This is a performance-based business. But we get on guys sometimes when they don't pitch hurt. So I don't know what the truth is about Sean Manaea. I think it's a big reason why next year in 2026, when we're doing off-season Ricos and we're breaking down what we think Sean Manaea is, there's going to be a lot of questions attached to him. There's going to be a debate. Was he just not healthy? He's probably going to have off-season surgery. In fact, I think he has to have off-season surgery to clean up the loose bodies. Was it health, or was it the fact that maybe the second half of last year was a mirage? Both are fair. I don't think any of us know the answer. I think we'll get the answer at some point, but it doesn't feel like we're getting it now. It feels like right now we are waiting for something with Manaea that's not changing. He's not the same guy he was last year. And what's troublesome, much like everyone else in this rotation, is he can't even get you through five innings. Like, I'm not going to sit here and tell you five innings, four runs is something to celebrate, but 3 2/3 innings, five runs is an abomination. Like, it's a problem. So I think we are at the point with Manaea where we have to have the same conversations we're having about Kodai Senga, which is, what do you do? Now, the Mets have already announced he's going to pitch on Monday against the Philadelphia Phillies. I mean, geez, does anybody have confidence in that? And what's weird about the Mets spot right now with Manaea and Senga, who we'll get to, is that they do have other options. You know, sometimes throughout a baseball season, and I remember when we had this discussion back in June when their rotation started to struggle and Griffin Canning went down and Manaea still wasn't back and Senga was hurt, they didn't have options. And we'd say, well, who do you want them to pitch? The Mets have options. We've talked a lot about Brandon Sproat, whose last minor league start was great. Tylor Megill is certainly a body and was someone who was effective in the first half of the year. So they have options. But I look at Monday with Manaea, since the Mets already announced he's going to pitch Monday, as this is your last chance. And it doesn't mean I'm cutting him or asking him to go to the minor leagues. I think he gets moved to the bullpen. And I think you try to see if whatever's going on with Sean, whether it is the loose bodies bothering him or it's just ineffectiveness. Sometimes we try to find reasons for why guys are struggling. When we talk about Ryan Helsley, there's like a million different reasons we try to come up with. But you try something different because this is the time of year where you can't waste that much time. Would I start him against the Phillies on Monday? I don't feel good about it. And I think what the Mets need to do before Sean Manaea toes the rubber ever again for this team, so before Monday, or what they have to do if Kodai Senga ends up making a start, is I think you have to have another starting pitcher up here and available, ready to clean this thing up if he gets knocked out in the second or third inning. Because it is not fair, nor is it sustainable, to have your relievers, and I don't mean like a starter who comes in to eat up innings, but your relievers, like we saw on Monday, have to come in the fourth inning. It was one of those days, I'll geek out with you, where my scorebook gets filled with pitchers. I show it to the YouTube audience. You probably can't see it. But Soto, Stanek, Rogers, Helsley, Raley, Diaz. I mean, he went to everybody. He went to everybody not named Waddell and Hagenman. That is not sustainable. So as we talk about Manaea's struggles on Labor Day, if he's going to pitch Monday against the Phillies, and this is a Met team that changes their roster every 30 seconds, Tylor Megill should be activated and ready to at least pitch out of the bullpen that day and eat up four innings. Because after the Mets off day, which they have between Detroit and Cincinnati, the Thursday, September 4th off day, they have another stretch of games where they play a lot. I think it's 10 straight days. I mean, go out there and add a guy to this roster like Megill or Sproat, who's ready to clean up Manaea's mess. Because what we saw on Monday is unacceptable. He gives up the home run to Jamai Jones. And even though he worked out of trouble in the second inning, his pitch count was 45 through two. I mean, you knew he wasn't going deep into the game. But credit to the Met offense and credit to the bottom of the order, specifically Luis Torrens, who was awesome on Labor Day, and obviously Juan Soto. We saw the Met offense immediately respond to Manaea giving up that home run, and I wasn't sure of that. I mean, Charlie Morton is a kind of a mixed bag. Like, we've seen Charlie Morton dominated at times where you can't hit the Uncle Charlie, and then other times he can't throw strikes, and he's knocked out in the fourth inning. Luckily, the Mets got to Charlie Morton. Vientos got hit by a pitch. McNeil came through behind in the count with a base hit. And then, and I love this, I'm not a big bunter, but when Cedric Mullins came up with 2-1 and nobody out in the second inning, I love that bunt. And I feel like I have to defend myself on why. You had Torrens and Beatty coming up. But if you listen to the Rico a lot, we had talked a couple of Ricos ago about the idea of keeping Torrens in a game in which they needed contact to tie the game, and instead they went to Marte, who struck out. Remember that? I kind of trust Torrens in a spot like that. So I viewed, especially with Beatty batting ninth, who is a much better ninth place hitter than your normal ninth place hitter, and Mullins stinks. I mean, let's get that out of the way. I mean, he's hitting 180 as a Met. I'm not making this up. He's not even matching his Oriole totals when he hit about 220, and he has not been good. So 2-1, nobody out, second inning already down by a run. I actually love that he bunted, and I was surprised by it. The Mets have been doing a lot of bunting recently, a lot of bunting in this series and in this game. So Mullins lays down the bunt, and then Torrens actually came through with a two-run double. I was just looking for, you know, an RBI ground out or a sacrifice fly. So a huge hit by Torrens that was set up by good hitting behind in the count by Jeff McNeil, a nice bunt by Cedric Mullins, and then Luis Torrens coming through. And not only that, I'll give you the other examples of the bunting that we saw on Labor Day. Torrens bunted later in the game when he came up with 2-1 and nobody out in the seventh inning, and that was off of a 3-for-3 to start the game. And I forget the exact situation. I think it was the sixth inning when Beatty showed bunt. Or that may have actually been the next day. I know there was another example of a bunt attempt that never got executed, but was certainly a thought that I didn't mind. And I think it was Brett Beatty. So we saw the Mets trying, even in a game that was a high-scoring affair, to be smart. And I like that. I think one of the beauties of Brett Beatty batting ninth, which I am not against, is A, he's got the great protection of Lindor behind him, and B, when you have a weaker hitter, whether it's Mullins or Torrens, you can lay down a bunt and not just have Beatty coming up, but have Lindor coming up. But then you have Juan Soto. Juan Soto is starting to heat up. I mean, starting to heat up is probably not accurate. He's been heated up for a while. I think what's changed with Juan Soto over the last few weeks is that when he heated up in June, I don't even know if that's the correct grammar, when he hotted up, that doesn't make sense. When he got very hot in June and he put up those big numbers, I would sit here and say, hey, he's having a great month, but it's still not impactful. Like, he's still not getting clutch hits. It's similar to what happened to Pete Alonso a year earlier. Like, the numbers are good, but it isn't impactful. It hasn't been clutch. It's part of why I started calling him Juan Solo. Paringo started calling him Juan Solo. Like, he was productive, but it felt like it was empty at times. What's changed is it's not empty. And that's great. Like, I'm loving it. We're all loving it. And he hit the home run over the weekend, which I thought had a chance to be the Soto moment, the game where they were trailing 8-2, hits the two-run home run to tie the game. This place is going nuts. And it's like, damn, Juan Soto has arrived. Well, I think we got a new Juan Soto moment, a new candidate for the Juan Soto moments, because he's been on fire lately. And that was the at-bat in the fourth inning. Let's not forget everything about that fourth inning. The Mets blow a 2-1 lead when Sean Manaea gives up yet another home run, this time a two-run shot to Wencil Perez. Okay? So here we are in the game. They're down 3-2. It's the top of the fourth inning, so it's still early in the game. And the bottom half of the order creates this great scoring opportunity. McNeil doubles again behind in the count. He's had some great at-bats recently. Mullins, to his credit, draws a walk. And Torrens bloops one in the right field. So the Mets are down by a run. They got the bases loaded and nobody out. Great. Here we go. Beatty, Lindor, Soto, Mets are ready to feast. Mets are ready to, at the bare minimum, tie the game, but in all likelihood, take the lead. Beatty strikes out. Okay? A little nervous, but we got Lindor coming up. Lindor strikes out. And at this point, the fourth inning is now looking like the inning we're going to talk about on the Rico Brugna. Like, you knew they lost during this inning. They were down 3-2. They had the bases loaded, nobody out, and they took a giant turd in their pants. And Soto falls behind in the count 1-2. And I admit, I'm like, all right, this is a disaster inning. And I'm not just going to blame Soto. I'm going to blame Lindor. I'm going to blame Beatty. It was just a bad, bad inning. And he gets under one, which off the bat, I wasn't sure if it was going to get out, mainly because no one can see baseballs during afternoon games.
Hello, it's Lena Dunham. I host a podcast called The C Word with my dearest friend and historian of bad behavior, Alyssa Bennett.
What is up?
It's a chat show about women whose society is called crazy.
We're going to be rediscovering the stories of women's society dismissed by calling them mad, sad, or just plain bad.
Listen to and follow The C Word with Lena Dunham and Alyssa Bennett. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Games in Detroit, which we discovered. And as it's flying towards the fence in right field, it's like slow motion in my brain. Is he actually going to hit a grand slam? This guy has literally only hit solo home runs or two-run home runs all year. He earned the Juan Solo nickname. I wasn't being a jerk. That was the reality. And as it's flying through the air, now I get up and I'm screaming, get out! Get out! Watching this game outside. It's Labor Day. It's a beautiful day. And when it clears the wall and goes out, it was this exhilarating feeling of, all right, this is Juan Soto. The guy at that point had hit 35 home runs as a New York Met. 35. He would tack on one the next day. 35 home runs and 25 of the 35 were solo home runs. Like, I'm not, it's not like I make it up. And the other 10 were two-run home runs.
I'm Kristen Press.
And I'm Tobin Heath.
We're World Cup winners, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Every week, we sit down with the icons, disruptors, and game changers on the field and beyond it to talk victories, heartbreaks, and everything in between.
We've built a space where athletes, changemakers, and people creating the future of women's sports can show up and show off as their full, unapologetic selves.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
And so to hit a grand slam, and not all grand slams are created equal, right? This could have been up 8-2 in the eighth inning, and it would have felt meaningless. But it wasn't only down in the game. Granted, it's early, it's the fourth inning, but it comes in an inning in which looked like the offense was going to leave the bases loaded after having nobody out. So a huge swing, I think a huge moment for Juan Soto. And then what happens? What happens right after that? Sean Manaea gives a run back and gives a second run back. And the Tigers are immediately taking that 6-3 deficit. And they're actually set up with a great opportunity to tie the game. And, you know, Gregory Soto, who did not have a great series and has not pitched well, at least got Perez to fly out on the first pitch and bailed Manaea out from just giving it all back in the fourth inning. So it was a great moment by Soto, Juan Soto, that is. But you kind of knew, like, they're going to need more. I mean, the way the Met pitching's going, you knew they were going to need more. And this is where I get mad at Gregory Soto. This is where, later in the podcast, I'm going to pitch that Gregory Soto's the net negative. He got the big out in the fourth inning. He gives up a base hit to Torkelson. He strikes out Riley Green. He gives up another base hit to Andy Ibañez. And it's like, come on, Gregory. Can you get me a couple of cleanouts? And instead, they then got to hand the baseball to Ryan Stanek. And what does Ryan Stanek do? He throws a wild pitch, and they tie the game. It wasn't an implosion because he got through the inning, and he was freaking lucky he got through the inning because Kerry Carpenter lined one right at Juan Soto. But it took the Mets only two innings to blow the Juan Soto grand slam. But what was so beautiful to see, and it gets back to Soto, is after they blow the lead, they respond again. Luis Torrens, who was all over this game with a blue pit, Beatty grounds out, Lindor gets hit by a pitch, and then Soto supplies a two-run triple to tack on 5-6 RBIs, give the Mets the lead. I still thought they needed more runs. Luckily, they got it when Brandon Nimmo delivered an RBI single, and luckily they got it again when the Tigers played bad defense, hello, Gleyber Torres, and they were able to get that run total to 10 and then hold on to your life. Because after Stanek pitched the fifth, I'm mapping this game out knowing, all right, it's like like you're out of breath because you know they got today and they got two more games before an off day. Are they able to use their entire bullpen? And luckily, because of Brandon Waddell, who I thank you, Brandon. Because Brandon Waddell cleaned up Senga's mess from Sunday and finished the entire game, the Mets had a fresh bullpen. I'm telling you, Brandon Waddell, what's up, Wads? I know he's not on the roster anymore. He got optioned. That is like a default, I'm the man now, star of the series. Like, Waddell needs honorable mention because without him cleaning up Senga's mess and the Mets having to use extra relievers on Sunday, who knows if they can unload the entire bullpen on Monday? And they did. Tyler Rogers in the sixth inning, I had no problem with it. It was the top of the Tigers' order. And I'm thinking at that point, this is a six-out kind of day for Diaz, or at least a multi-out kind of day for Edwin Diaz. So he gets through the sixth, Rogers, and he wasn't great. Like, he didn't give up a run, but he got a great defensive play by Cedric Mullins. It wasn't the most dominant inning in the world. And then you got Ryan Helsley. And this is where Carlos Mendoza is probably looking at his bullpen and saying, guys, what do you want me to do? At this point in the game, he had Rayleigh Diaz and I guess Justin Hagenman, who you're not using. He's another I'm going to clean up the mess kind of guy. So the only other option that Mendy had on Monday was to try to get nine outs from Diaz and Rayleigh. And I think because it was a three-run lead, his attitude was, and I actually agreed with this at the time, I got the lead. If he puts the first three guys on base, he's out of the game. If he puts one guy on base and gets two outs, I'll give him another batter. If he puts two guys on base and gets one out, I'll take him out of the game. And that's exactly how he handled it. He gave up the leadoff double, but then he got the next two guys out. So Helsley was like on the verge of at least getting through the seventh inning. As soon as he gave up the base hit to Zach McKinstry, Mendy was right to say, okay, get out. And he goes to Brooks Rayleigh. And underratedly, Brooks Rayleigh has pitched well. He gets the big out to get out of the inning. He does give up the leadoff double in the eighth inning to Jahmy Jones, but is at least able to get the next two out. So even though Detroit gets another run back to make it at that point 10-8, it's like, all right, Rayleigh to a degree did his job. And by the way, Helsley came in with a four-run lead, not a three-run lead. So it was a little bit more comfortable. But I thought that Mendy handled it perfectly. It's not easy when you don't have a lot of good options. And so I thought taking Manaea out was a must. Going to Soto is probably the best matchup. Going to Stanek, as much as we can't stand him, again, like, where else are you going? Rogers in the sixth, Helsley in the seventh, Rayleigh to clean up the mess, and then Diaz to come in to face Torkelson with two outs in the eighth inning. Like, made sense. And then you needed Edwin Diaz to be Edwin Diaz. And he mostly has been, and he delivered the goods. And that's what we need as Met fans more than anything, Edwin Diaz to continue to be maybe the best closer in the history of the franchise. And I don't think we're that far away from saying that. I will always appreciate John Franco. Many olders will appreciate Tug McGraw and Jesse Orosco. But in terms of dominance, and now in terms of like clutch moments and also what he's asked to do, I mean, he may be the best closer in the history of the team. That's an off-season pod. We'll break it down. But excellent, excellent job by Edwin Diaz by getting the final four outs. And they needed him to do it because they were really running short on that bullpen. They just did not have a lot of options. But keep the Helsley thing in mind. I thought Helsley was handled the exact right way. It's a four-run lead. I got the three-batter minimum, which is kind of a pain in the ass when you got a guy like Helsley. Can't just pull him after two batters. Lead off double, next two outs. I'll give you the next hitter. Gives up a hit, get him out. Mendy did not leave him in too long. So it was a really nice Labor Day victory. Luis Torrens was tremendous. Juan Soto was tremendous. And Edwin Diaz delivering the four-out save. Game two of this series, in a lot of ways, was the moment where I looked at Nolan McClain and those heart emojis were right there on my face. How do you not love Nolan McClain? How do you not love the guy? And what he did on Tuesday were the kinds of things that made me fall in love with DeGrom. See, my love affair with Jacob DeGrom was about two things. It was about the disrespect he got from my fellow Met fans. I don't need to get into all that, but he was disrespected. But the other thing Jake did was he showed balls constantly. He showed guts constantly. And I cited this on a recent Rico, that game in Philly when he was coming back from an injury and he threw 50 pitches in the first inning and somehow got through the first inning. And that was it. They pulled him out after that because he threw too many pitches. But it was incredible how he could get through a scoreless 50-pitch inning. We all remember the guts of Game 5 against the Dodgers. Like, I thought DeGrom was a real gutsy pitcher. And those two things, disrespect and guts, made him my favorite player. We're learning a lot about Nolan McClain. I don't think he's disrespected. I think Met fans are certainly in love with him. But the man has guts. Because what he did on Tuesday, I think, is more impressive than the 8 scoreless innings against the Phillies. You see, when you have electric stuff, when you have a sweeper that has spin we've never seen before, you deserve a lot of credit, but things are easy. You have great stuff. You're throwing the baseball in a way in which it's impossible to hit. When you have to fight, when you have to claw, when you have to battle on a day that is not your best day, and oh, by the way, you're doing it against the Tigers, a team that's averaged 4.8 runs per game, a team that's one of the better teams in the American League, and you're doing it on the road. That's when you really grow. So Nolan McClain wasn't good in the first two innings. Typical of a really good pitcher. If you get to him, you better get to him early. First batter of the game got absolutely robbed by Pete Alonso. Amazing defense, robbing Colt Keith of a double. And after he struck out Glaber, he issued the back-to-back walks and then gave up the back-to-back hits. Now, luckily, he got help. Juan Soto threw to the plate. Torrens very promptly threw to second base. And they cut down Wenciel Perez after he drove in the Tigers' second run. Keep that in the back of your mind. That was a really good play by Torrens. He knew exactly what to do. Throw the baseball to second. Get that runner, at least end the inning. Sure, it sucks they're down 2-1. Sure, it sucks that McClain gave back the Pete Alonso home run that was hit the previous inning, but limit the damage. You go to the second inning. He gives up a leadoff walk to Zach McKinstry. And again, Luis Torrens really helped a friend out because McKinstry's trying to steal second, and Torrens nails him with another one of those perfect throws that's right into the runner. And even though Dylan Dingler got a base hit right after, McClain was given a free out, two free outs in the first two innings. And he was able to very calmly get the next two outs. 44 pitches through two innings. He got six outs. Four of the outs, he got the other two lucky. I think we're all kind of worried. Like, all right, this is going to be a tough one. It's 2-1 Detroit. I'm not necessarily worried about the offense. I figured they'll eventually get to Sawyer, Gibson, Long. I'm worried about Nolan. I'm worried about McClain. I'm worried about how far in this game can he go? He's thrown 44 pitches. His command has been way off. He's walked three guys. He can't really control that sweeper. It's just an ugly day. Disappointing, but it happens. He's young. And what does this guy do? 1-2-3, easy third inning. 1-2-3, easy fourth inning. He throws 22 pitches to get the next six outs. What does he do after that? He strikes out the side. What does he do after that? 1-2-3 inning. He goes out and he retires 14 in a row. After we're looking at him saying, just a bad night. What can you do? And there's something so awesome about it. And there's also something so pathetic about everyone else in this rotation about it. Sean Manaea, Podai Senga, Clay Holmes, even David Peterson. Why don't you take a look? You see that? Ain't that hard, bro. He did not have his best stuff. He did not have his best command. And yet, by accident, threw six innings. And quite frankly, if the Mets weren't trying to protect him or think about bringing him back on regular rest, he could have pitched the seventh. His pitch count was 90. At that rate, he was going to get through the next inning less than 100. That was marvelous by Nolan McLain. Marvelous. And it is four starts. I recognize that. I'm not going to boomer this and say he's Tom Seaver. I'm not going to say he's Jacob DeGrom. I don't know what he is, but he's spectacular. And he is everything this team needs. This rotation is soft. This rotation never goes deep into games as a whole. I'm talking about everybody. David Peterson once in a while will go deep into a game. I don't want to necessarily lump him in, because even though he has struggled recently, I appreciate David Peterson's season. Everyone else has pitched so softly this season. They nibble. They don't go deep into games. And are they ever able to battle when their stuff isn't great? And here's a kid in his fourth major league start against one of the better offenses in baseball who said, "Why don't you watch?" So it's inspiring, but it's also kind of an indictment on the rest of the rotation. The Mets set world records, MLB records, for the longest stretch of games where they couldn't get six from their starter. The guy does it every time out. He didn't do it in his first start. He's done it in his next three starts after all of these guys couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. Senga couldn't do it. Manaea couldn't do it. Montas couldn't do it. Holmes couldn't do it. Nobody could do it. And here's Nolan McLain saying, "No biggie," to borrow a phrase from a buddy. Great work by Nolan McLain. And then, yeah, the Met offense was outstanding. I mean, Pete Alonso jumped on a 3-0 pitch, which was nice, and delivered it over the fence. Luis Torren, shockingly, went opposite field and hit a 3-run home run behind in the count. We saw more clutch hitting from Jeff McNeil, who had a really good offensive series. And we saw the Mets have that big fourth inning and then jump on it even more and really put this game out of reach when Beatty came through with a hit. Soto and Alonso went back-to-back. McNeil drove in two more runs. It was an all-around great offensive effort. I guess the one guy, and I like this. This makes me happy. When the Mets can score 12 runs and Francisco Lindor could be 0-for-4, I think that's great. And I think it's a sign that this lineup was getting contributions from everybody. So an amazing effort by Nolan McLain, a wonderful effort by the offense. I talked earlier, way at the beginning of this pod, about the defense, the Pete Alonso play, which was spectacular. And then Luis Torrens. I mean, Luis Torrens is a hell of a catcher. The caught stealing was such a big moment in this game. And so for that reason, here on episode 541 of the Rico Bronya, before we even get to game three, let's just get it out of the way. Let's pick our Rico, I'm the man now, star of the series. And before we do that, let's celebrate. Whoever we're going to give this award to, we could celebrate with a Mio Sparkling Sake, which I have in my hands right now. Celebrate your highlights with Mio Sparkling Sake, a true crowd pleaser, light, bubbly, easy to enjoy. Whether you're at Citi Field or your favorite spot, ask for Mio Sparkling Sake by name, a new tradition served chilled, imported from Japan. It's the official sake of Rico Bronya. Enjoy responsibly. So I got a lot of candidates for the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series. But the man who deserves it more than anybody else, before we get into the other honorable mentions, is Luis Torrens. And to me, it's a two-man race. I'm not including McLain. I'm giving McLain a break from this award because he only impacted one game. But Juan Soto is obviously the other guy. I mean, the guy drove in six runs on Labor Day, hit the grand slam, hit a triple. I mean, a historic kind of offensive performance. He gets two more hits, including a solo home run in the seventh inning. It wasn't that big. It was more, these are his numbers and it's impressive. So I think from an impactful standpoint, I think his stolen base in the fourth inning was very impactful. And obviously his offensive performance in game one was, but Soto ended up going 5 for 11, hit two home runs, drove in 7 runs, and he was on base 8 times. It was a wonderful series for Juan Soto. But Luis Torrens not only went 3 for 3 on Labor Day with 2 RBIs, he not only backed it up by going 2 for 5 in game two with that huge 3-run home run. I mean, just a monstrous part of the game. The Mets had just taken a 3-2 lead, and that 3-run home run gave Nolan McClain the wiggle room. But the defense, the caught stealing of McKinstry in the second inning was so important. I don't know where this game goes if he doesn't make that play. Now, I think McClain is tough enough where maybe he battles through the second inning, but even if it's something small like he battles through the second inning, but his pitch count is higher, maybe he doesn't go 6, maybe he goes 5. So I think a lot of things change if Luis Torrens isn't responsible for 2 of the first 6 outs that help McClain fight through those first 2 innings. The throw to second to get Perez after the RBI hit in the first and the caught stealing. So it's not just, hey, Torrens was 5 for 10 with a home run and 5 RBIs, which is pretty awesome anyway. It's the defense. Now, Pete Hoffman is monitoring the Rico Bronya, but he's a part of a fantasy draft. So if Pete Hoffman ends up disagreeing with me, too bad. He's too busy drafting Braylon Allen 2 rounds before he should. But I think it's Luis Torrens. A very much honorable mention of Juan Soto. Wonderful series. He's on fire. He's been amazing. Thank you, Juan Soto. I'm not even calling him Juan Solo, even though he did hit a solo home run to start the seventh inning. Even though his home runs are still, like, here's the breakdown, just so we know, so we have context. Juan Soto's hit 37 home runs, which is great. I mean, he's right on the verge of breaking his career mark of a year ago. Of the 37, 26 are solo home runs. 26 of 37. 10 are 2 run shots, 1 is a grand slam. For context, last year when he hit 40, he hit 23 solo home runs, 12 2-run home runs, and 5.
Hello, it's Lena Dunham. I host a podcast called The C Word with my dearest friend and historian of bad behavior, Alyssa Bennett.
What is up?
It's a chat show about women whose society is called crazy.
We're going to be rediscovering the stories of women's society dismissed by calling them mad, sad, or just plain bad.
Listen to and follow The C Word with Lena Dunham and Alyssa Bennett. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
3-run home runs. So there you go. But don't take this as a knock on Soto. The guy's been awesome, and he deserves honorable mention for his performance in this series against the Tigers. The other guy is Edwin Diaz. I mean, that was, it's a 4-out save, and it ain't easy. And Edwin Diaz did that very, very calmly. So honorable mention to Edwin Diaz, honorable mention to Pete Alonso after he took an offer in the opener, Labor Day. He went 2 for 5 with a pair of home runs in game two. Even in game three, the game they lost, they only scored 2 runs. He was 3 for 4 with an RBI. So overall, a good series by him. Honorable mention to Jeff McNeil, had 2 hits in the opener. 3 hits in game two, ended up going 6 for 11 with 3 RBIs and a decent series from Brandon Nimmo as well. Honorable mention to Nolan McClain. Honorable mention to Brooks Raley. Actually, not really. I take that back. But it's between Torrens and Soto. And I believe the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series is Luis Torrens for the very first time. So the New York Mets have now played, are you ready for this? 44 different series. Okay, so there's been 44 Rico I'm the Man Now stars of the series. 21 different people have won the award. Isn't that kind of crazy? Luis Torrens has won it, but currently the leaders, Pete Alonso 6, Francisco Lindor 5, Juan Soto 3. So there you go. Let's get to game 3 of this series. That was the game on Wednesday afternoon, the most recent game. And here's my issue. And I don't want to spend too much time killing the offense. It happens. They scored 22 runs in the first 2 games. Obviously, they had opportunities. Starling Marte with the bases loaded, bouncing into a double play, down 3-2. That's your clutch moment that you'll remember. This, to me, is about Clay Holmes, and it's about the bullpen. Let's start with Clay Holmes. Clay Holmes was good in this game. I mean, he was good in this game. That's the way I would phrase it. He was good in this game. He had very good stuff. I thought he was in complete command. Like, he struck out Carpenter and Riley Green effectively to get through the first inning. So he got through trouble there. Like, I thought he was good. He gives up the run in the second inning. That was really aided by the catcher's interference, which the catcher's interference is the most annoying rule in baseball. And you kind of knew when Baez reached on the Sanger interference, something bad would happen. Unfortunately, Jake Rogers came through with a base hit. But after that, pitched a 1-2-3 third inning, got through some issues in the fourth inning, including being helped out by a nice defensive play by Pete Alonso that turned into an unassisted double play. And then you get the fifth inning. And I feel like I'm the kiss of death, because at that point in the fifth inning of a game that is 1-1, I'm looking at Clay's pitch count and I'm thinking he can get through six, or at least can get this game into the sixth inning. He strikes out Jake Rogers to start the inning. All right, so here we go. And then he walks Colt Keith, and he wasn't even close. Wasn't even close. He got Gleyber Torres to ground out, and now he's facing Kerry Carpenter in a spot in which you cannot walk him. And once he walks him, he allowed Carlos Mendoza to make a move that I disagree with. And I have proof I disagree with it because I said it live on the Fan. You know, usually we don't break in too much to what's going on in the game, try to talk about other things, figuring Met fans are watching the game. But as Mendy was coming out in a 1-1 game with two on and two out in the fifth inning and his pitch count at 85, he went lefty-lefty, Soto to Riley Green. I didn't like the move, and I give you a couple of reasons. Number one, even though, yes, it's lefty-lefty, Holmes had handled Riley Green in his first two at-bats. His kick changeup, which was very effective in this game, are tough against lefties, and it was pretty effective against Riley Green in his first two at-bats. So number one, I liked the matchup. I didn't think it was a bad matchup. Number two, I wasn't convinced he was tired. Like, I know he had just walked Kerry Carpenter, but I wasn't at the point where, boy, the guy's on fumes. I didn't feel that way. Now, I admit I'm watching the game while doing a show, so I don't have the same attention that I would have to detail as if I'm watching every other game, but the way I felt. And the other reason I didn't want to go to Soto for Riley Green is Gregory Soto hasn't been very good. He got off to a good start while he was here. But overall, Gregory Soto has now been kind of a guy who comes in and you figure bad stuff's going to happen. So I view the option of Gregory Soto and knowing his inconsistencies and knowing the way he's pitched recently. And I look at Clay Holmes, who handled Riley Green so effectively in his first two at-bats, and I weighed the pros and the cons, and I said to myself, I'd rather Clay Holmes. I'll give him one more batter. Sucks that he walked the guy. But it's the fifth inning. And that's the other thing. It's the fifth inning. Bro, can you get me one more freaking out so I don't have to go to the bullpen in the fifth inning? And Gregory Soto commits two crimes. And this is why stats of relievers are so freaking overrated, because Gregory Soto's final line is an inning and a third of scoreless baseball. And boy, you see that. Or you have him in your fantasy league, you're like, oh, that's pretty good. No, it wasn't good. Because he throws a wild pitch and gives up a ball that was hit 110 miles an hour, got past Soto, got by Lindor. It's a 3-1 game. I don't trust the guy. I didn't trust him 2 days earlier on Labor Day. I didn't trust him when he imploded against the Marlins on August 28th. I didn't trust him when he struggled against the Braves. I mean, the guy hasn't been good. The guy just hasn't been good. So I know that Mendy's unfortunately in a spot where you have to go to players that we're not going to trust because your whole bullpen's littered with guys who you don't trust. But in that spot, I preferred Clay Holmes. And Tiki said to me live on the air, he's like, wow, Soto gets him out. Are you wrong? I'm like, not really. I mean, I still think it's a bad move. So I guess if you thought it was a good move, you still think it's a good move. But it didn't work. Now, that shouldn't be their death sentence because it's 3-2. It's still the top of the sixth once the inning is over and Soto got through it and the offense could respond. Or I should say it's 3-1. They would get a run in the sixth inning to make it 3-2. And that occurred on a clutch hit by Mark Vientos, which was great to see. And then, of course, Marte bounces into the double play. Marte has overall played well, and I do think the Mets' best lineup right now features Marte at DH. I thought the Met lineup that Mendy threw out there for the finale of this series, which featured Mullins on the bench and McNeil in center field and Vientos at third and Beatty at second and Marte at DH, I think it's their best lineup. And it certainly feels like Francisco Alvarez is going to come back. He had a grand slam on Wednesday in the minor league, so it looks like Alvarez is going to try to play through this thing. Their lineup is freaking deep, man. When you've got Alvarez back behind the plate and Marte at DH. Marte didn't get the job done, is what it is. The problem we run into is two innings later. Soto came up with a chance to tie the game. He grounded out. Okay, it sucks. Soto's had a great series. It comes down to the bottom of the seventh inning when he goes to Ryan Helsley. Here's my issue. The Mets have eight guys in their bullpen. And we could all argue where we rank the guys in our level of trust. Clearly, Diaz is number one, and I would think most of us would agree Raley is number two. After that, maybe we'll have a food fight on who we trust more or who we trust less. Tyler Rogers is a disappointment. Totally agree. But of the remaining guys in your bullpen, Tyler Rogers is the most trustworthy, or of the available guys, I would say. I put it this way. Ryan Helsley can't see this effing game. He can't see it. We saw what happened 2 days earlier when Mendy had the quick hook. And I get that at some point you have to use guys you don't trust. But here's the way I would view the seventh inning. Let me extend this game being close. Let me go to Tyler Rogers, who is one of my better relievers still available. Brooks Raley being the other. Let me keep this game close. Let me see if my offense can heat up. And yeah, I guess there's a possibility at some point I'm going to have to use Ryan Helsley, but not there. He has given you no indication and no reason to believe he's turning this around. He's not Devin Williams. What Devin Williams has done watching him with the Yankees is in a lot of ways even more frustrating because once they give him these low leverage spots and they ease Devin Williams into pitching, in spots where it's not a one-run lead in the eighth inning, he's good. He strikes out the side. He looks dominant. Then when Boone puts him back in a high-leverage spot, he implodes. And so you see that and you say, wow, the pressure's getting to the guy. And maybe it is. Ryan Helsley could be in a Little League game right now. He could face young Jet Roberts. He's going to get smoked. He can't get anybody out. And we could spend 20 minutes trying to figure out the why. Mendy's peppered with questions like that. Is he tipping his pitches? Is it mechanical? Is it this? Is it that? Is it New York? Is it not that? I'm at the point, guy. I don't care what it is. He cannot pitch in a one-run game in the bottom of the seventh. And this is one of those days where you can't tell me he didn't have other options. The day before, he only used Ryan Stanek and Kevin Hergett. That was it. Rogers was available. Raley was available. You cannot go to Helsley in a one-run game. And the Mets right now have two options with Ryan Helsley. And I'm going to say something so sympathetic right now. I feel bad for Ryan Helsley. He is not trying to stink. I don't even think he's intimidated by New York. He stands there after every game and he tries to answer the why, and he doesn't know. So I don't think Ryan Helsley is a bad guy, and I really don't even think he's shrinking by New York. I think something's wrong. I wish I knew. I don't know if it's as simple as tipping pitches. He's just getting smoked. His slider is getting smoked. His fastball, which he does not have great command of, is getting smoked. So you can put him in a high-leverage situation, low-leverage situation. It doesn't matter. The guy's getting ripped by everybody. So let's get back to the options, because he let the game, you know, go away. All right, there's nothing else to say about this game. He came in and he imploded and he gave up a home run to Kerry Carpenter. And yes, Juan Soto came close to robbing him. The ball was hit over the fence. It's on Helsley. If you're Mendoza and you're David Stearns, you can literally DFA him. You can cut your losses. You can say, you know what? We'd love to fix him. We don't have time to fix you. There is only 3.5 weeks left in the season. Sorry, we don't have time. So we're going to do you a favor. We're going to put you out of your misery. If you want to catch on with another team, even though you won't be eligible for the postseason, good luck and God bless. You can do that. Would it look bad for David Stearns? This already looks bad for David Stearns. He had a miserable trade deadline. We thought it was good. We liked it at the time. And I warned, because it's the truth about relievers, you truly never know. You think you know, you don't know. But either you get rid of him or you relegate him to situations where he can't harm you. That harmed you on Wednesday. That was harmful. So why are you doing it? Why put him in situations like that? Why allow him to pitch in a game that's a one-run game? Why would you do that? Do you hate him or do you hate your fans? Which one is it? He can't pitch in a game like that. And again, I'll give you the two options. I know most people in the emails are saying DFA him. That's fine. You could DFA him. It would actually show me something about the Mets meaning business, which we've seen a lot of over the last 2 years, where, hey, we paid you $17 million, Frankie Montas. Too bad. You stink. You're out of the rotation. We signed you to a contract, Joey Wendell. Too bad. We're DFAing you. We traded relatively valuable prospects for you, Ryan Helsley. You were once a really good closer. Too bad. You can't get anybody out. You have an ERA over 11 as a New York Met. Sorry. We can't do it anymore. Now, here's where I'm going to depress everybody. And I could not wait to look this up because I knew it would be bad. I knew it, but I wanted to see it with my own two beautiful hazel eyes. As a New York Met, I'd like to read you Ryan Helsley's stats. You guys ready? He has now made 14 appearances. He's thrown 11 innings. He has given up 19 hits, 18 runs, 14 earned. That is an ERA of 11.45. Billy Taylor. Guys, remember Billy Taylor? Of course, the Mets traded Jason Isringhausen for Billy Taylor right before the trade deadline in 1999. Billy Taylor was having a relatively good year as the closer of the Oakland A's. He was 37, so he was older. But at the time with the A's, he had 26 saves, had pitched to a 3.98 ERA. He was having a good year, having a solid year as closer of the A's. And the Mets trade for him. He ended up making 18 appearances as a New York Met. Again, Helsley is at 14. Billy Taylor ended up throwing 13 and a third innings. Again, Ryan Helsley is at 11. So Billy ended up throwing a few innings more. Billy Taylor, who is, as we all know, an abomination as a Met acquisition, gave up 12 runs, all earned, an ERA of 8.10. Helsley has him beat. He's given up more runs. He has a worse ERA. He's literally worse than Billy Taylor. And for those of us who remember Billy Taylor and the abomination of a Met that he was, is that not all you need to know? He's Billy Taylor. And you know what the Mets ended up doing with Billy Taylor? Nothing. They didn't pitch him in the playoffs. They realized we can't have this guy around. And then Billy Taylor bounced around the league and was out of baseball within a year and a half. So I don't know if that's going to happen to Ryan Helsley. I hope that's not the case. He's still a relatively young man. But I'll be blunt. He cannot pitch in a situation like that ever again. He can't do it. Put him in low leverage spots if you can find him. And if he's effective, maybe he can earn his way back. Or you get rid of him. Now, net negative, and then we'll get to a lot of news and notes that we have to discuss. I'm very mixed about it. I mean, we can make Ryan Helsley the net negative. We could do that. I could argue Gregory Soto. I thought he negatively impacted two games, one of which they lost. I think he's a candidate. Personally, I don't want to give it to anybody offensively. I know Lindor did not have a great series, but I think with the Met offense, it would be it's almost disingenuous to give it to somebody on offense. We could give it to Sean Manaea. The problem was, while he impacted the rest of the series by not going deep into the game and the Mets having to use their entire bullpen, they did win. So I think this is between Gregory Soto and Ryan Helsley. And quite frankly, I think it's Gregory Soto. I do. Gregory Soto negatively affected multiple games. That's number one. Number two, Gregory Soto has one job on this team. Or, not fair, he has one specific thing he really needs to get done. When you come in to face a lefty, get him out. Not only does Gregory Soto in his job fail to get Riley Green out a lefty, he throws a wild pitch that allows him failing to get Riley Green out to not lead to one run, because that'd be bad enough, but two runs. So I look at Soto's implosion is not the right word because he got the third out. He then pitched the scoreless inning. So I know his final line wasn't bad, but you come in to face Riley Green and you don't get him out. And then I go to game one of this series. He did come in and clean up Manaea's mess, but then what does he do? He gives up a couple of base hits that set up the rally in the fifth that tied the game for the Detroit Tigers. He didn't do his job. He faced four batters. Two of them got on base. I'm sorry. Ryan Helsley is easy. He's like red meat. He came into a game. He let it slip away. It was bad. I don't know, man. To me, it's Gregory Soto. So I know I may get some shrapnel in the emails. You're not giving it to Helsley. I think it's Gregory Soto. And you know what? Right now I'm feeling also powerful because Pete Hoffman's doing a fantasy draft. So guess what? The net negative is Gregory Soto. Now, bunch of things I want to get to. Number one, Kodai Senga to the minor leagues. On the last Rico, we talked about what to do. My idea was to skip him. Kodai Senga should accept his trip to the minor leagues. He should accept it because he will look so bad if he doesn't. He has not been good. He has said after games, his body isn't moving in the right way. He has said after games, he'll do whatever it takes to help the team. And I honestly believe this from the bottom of my heart. I don't think going to the minor leagues means he's done. I don't. I think if Kodai goes down there, makes a start, fixes mechanics, or at least that's what they tell us, and pitches well, I would have no issue with him coming back. I don't think he's one of those guys that can't make another start. So I hope for the sake of Kodai Senga and for the sake of us that he accepts going to the minor leagues. I was confused because Senga has options, but apparently in the contract he signed coming over from Japan, that contract specifically said he needed to get permission to go to the minor leagues. So I hope he does. Now that leaves this weekend wide open. We know David Peterson's going to pitch Friday. I don't know what to think from David Peterson. He's been so up, so down. I hope the consistency can come back. It's a big game against the Reds, obviously. But Peterson, in hopefully a bounce-back role, goes Friday. Jonah Tong, I'm excited about because I still feel like there's this air of mystery around him. He pitched well against the Marlins, but it was so tough to judge because they gave him such an early, monstrous lead. So I don't know what to expect from Jonah Tong, but I'm intrigued. That's for damn sure. And they're throwing him right into a tough situation, having to face the Cincinnati Reds, where the Reds are in it and the Giants are in it. And so while I feel relatively comfortable about where the standings lay as far as making the postseason, look, the Mets are easily a sweep away from it becoming a disaster. I get that. Sunday needs to be Nolan McClain. And it needs to be Nolan McClain for two very, very important reasons. As I go through the Rico email, Kendrick from Suffern, who is a great, not only emailer to the Rico, but a listener to WFAN, had a great point. And he made this point before the Mets kind of leaked out, Senga may go to the minors. And I want you to read his email because he nails why Nolan McClain needs to pitch Sunday. Needs to pitch Sunday on what's called regular rest. 4 days rest, it's regular rest. Kendrick writes, "Hey, Evan," and again, this is Monday, so this is right after Senga struggles. We certainly got the idea from Mendy that he wasn't committing to Senga making another start. But here's what Kendrick writes. Hey, Evan, with the uncertainty around Kodai Senga, here's a thought about how the Mets should handle the rotation this week. Dare I say, here's my vision for the big stretch of games. I think the Mets should line up Nolan McLain to pitch both Tuesday, check, and Sunday. Doing that would line him up perfectly against the Reds. That spot in the schedule could be huge. It's either a chance to go for the sweep, prevent a disaster, or lock down a series win. But there's another layer to it. Starting him on Tuesday and Sunday prevents McLain from seeing the Phillies twice in a short span. More importantly, it eliminates the risk of the Phillies getting a third look at him in a five-week span if we were to meet in the wild card round. That's the kind of forward thinking that could play off big. He is 1,000% right. First of all, I'd argue the games against Cincinnati at this point are bigger than Philadelphia. I'd like to win the division. Unfortunately, it feels unrealistic. So I think making sure you put the Reds away, even though the Giants are in this too, is most important. So not only are you kind of putting your best pitcher up against the more important game, you're avoiding the Phillies from seeing him for a third time. So I completely agree. I don't know if the Mets are thinking that way, but they should. And of course, the cherry on top. If the Mets line it up this way, it sets the stage for Nolan McLain versus Jacob DeGrom on September 12th at Citi Field. Can you imagine the energy in the ballpark for that one? It would be incredible. Almost a storybook moment. It would be amazing. And there's nothing in Met history that rivals it. Like, Doc's return wasn't against some young stud. Tom Seaver's return was actually against Jerry Kuzman, which was more friend versus friend, right? Like, rotation mate versus rotation mate. Like, DeGrom returning and facing, you know, Matt Harvey if he was still around, that would be that. DeGrom returning and facing his replacement in a lot of ways, like the heir to the throne potentially, is magical. Now, that's not the reason you do it, and Kendrick certainly isn't implying that. The reason you do it is to set him up to face Cincinnati and then obviously have the Phillies avoid him. Other thing is Jesse Winker's done for the season. It stinks. And you know what it reminds me of with Jesse Winker being done for the season? David Stearns had a really bad offseason and trade deadline. Now, the Mets could still win the World Series, right? That's great. But if you go through the moves that he made, whether it's Frankie Montas, or it's even Sean Manaea in year one, or it's Jesse Winker, it's bad, man. And the trade deadline, ain't good either. Helsley is unpitchable. Rodgers can still be very good, but he's been a disappointment. And Cedric Mullins has even been worse than what he was in Baltimore. So it's just an observation. I like David Stearns. I think we all do, but we got to call it out. I mean, this has been bad. Most of his moves have not worked out. And then you've got Tyrone Taylor going to the IL, which stinks. He was starting to play well. We know about his defense in center field. But what this should force Mendy to do, and he did it on Wednesday, and I want to see him continue this to a degree, is Cedric Mullins cannot be guaranteed center field, and Jeff McNeil has played a good enough center field where he's got to be a factor. This Cincinnati series coming up. Here is what they are scheduled to face. And the Reds have their guys lined up. Andrew Abbott is going to pitch the Friday game. He has had some bad starts recently, but overall has had a really good year. Tough lefty. Brady Singer is going to go in the Saturday game. And then Hunter Green is going to pitch the Sunday game against McLain. How about that matchup? Talk about young studs. McLain and Hunter, that's pretty damn good. So where things stand with the Reds is if the Mets win the series, they will likely take the tiebreaker because the tiebreaker would not be head-to-head because they would split the head-to-head if the Mets win 2 out of 3. So the next tiebreaker is your record against your division. So here's where things stand on that right now. The Mets right now against the National League East, and it certainly didn't help what happened against Miami, are 23-19. Cincinnati is 17-22. So the Mets will, in all likelihood, have that tiebreaker if they win 2 out of 3. If they win 2 out of 3, they will they'll finish ahead of the Reds. That's where I'm at. If they lose two out of three, look, you open up Pandora's box. You open up the fact that this thing could get dicey. The Giants are now a team you have to keep an eye on as they are climbing up the standings. But the Mets, too, have the tiebreaker on San Francisco. So the Mets will at least have that kind of in their possession. The other thing is Alvarez. This is a huge, huge, huge addition if they can get Francisco Alvarez back. And he can be effective and pick up where he left off. I mean, he's clearly going to try to play through the thumb and the pinky issue. But the key is going to be, can Alvarez just pick up where he left off? And if that's the case, then this lineup, which has been mashing for a month and a half, only gets better. Now, here's the other thing about the Rico. I want to do an off day Rico. So we will have one, and I invite you guys to be a part of it. There are some of these series recaps. We just don't get to any emails, or we don't get to enough emails. So we invite your emails at therico@gmail.com, whether it's about this roster, whether it's about the postseason, whether it's about really anything, and we will have a mailbag off-day Rico coming your way. So I look forward to that, and we want you to be a part of it, so you can email us therico@gmail.com. And we'll get you set for the Cincinnati series and really the final stretch drive as the Mets look to secure their second straight postseason spot. And you know, we figure out what this team's going to look like. But before we go, we have a new game here on the Rico Bronya. At the end of every series, I give you my updated, this is what their playoff rotation should be. Because I think this is a game that's going to be altered day by day by day. So after the Miami series, my threesome of starters was McLean, Manaea, and Peterson. Spoiler alert, that's about to change. Hoffman's three was McLean, Tong, and an opener that goes inning by inning. Here's where I'm at. I'm going to write it down so I don't forget. Obviously, Nolan McLean. I mean, that ain't changing. That's only being locked up even more. So I stick with Nolan McLean. I stick with David Peterson, and I can't be Manaea. I think it's Clay Holmes. As much as Clay Holmes disappointed me in not being able to get through the fifth inning on Wednesday, I trust him a lot more right now than Manaea and Senga. So Jonah Tong can easily change that by the way he pitches on Saturday. But as of right now, my playoff rotation would be McLean, Peterson, and Holmes. But I think Holmes would certainly have other starters ready, whether it's Brandon Sproat, who still hasn't made his major league debut, or even Sean Manaea himself. Either way, we appreciate you listening and downloading episode 551 of the week. Oh, look, Pete Hoffman's here!
I'm here. I started hearing about the rotation for the playoffs.
Yes.
So I'm going to keep it. It's McLean, Tong, and opener slash bullpen. I don't trust any of these assholes. I'm sorry.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Thank you, Pete. Here's your contribution in the final 30 seconds. Now, he contributes to the whole thing. I mean, he runs the Rico Bronya. And I do appreciate Pete. He always has this thing up. Wait till football season starts this weekend, and he's in the Giant locker room while Ricos are going on. Anyhow, we appreciate you listening and downloading another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.
Hello, it's Lena Dunham. I host a podcast called The C Word with my dearest friend and historian of bad behavior, Alyssa Bennett.
What is up?
It's a chat show about women whose society is called crazy.
We're going to be rediscovering the stories of women's society dismissed by calling them mad, sad, or just plain bad.
Listen to and follow The C Word with Lena Dunham and Alyssa Bennett, available now wherever you get your podcasts.